Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the second weekend of August 2025. We are in the late summer season, rapidly approaching fall, it feels like, to me at least, but it is the, climatically speaking, the warmest time of the year here in Sitka. Over this period, we average, the average temperature high is in the 60s, and starting kind of early September, it starts falling there pretty rapidly as we are losing daylight. But for now, we have some warm weather and still relatively long days. It's a good time to get out. And if you are getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org. Leave me a comment there. There's still a few of the late season wildflowers blooming, especially if you get up at higher elevations, and the birds have pretty much wrapped up their breeding season. I've seen some song sparrows still feeding young recently, but they probably are song sparrows that maybe even had as many as three broods over the summer season. As the resident birds, they have the opportunity to get started early and stretch it a little bit later, but many of the other migrants have started kind of joining up in these loose flocks that I notice from time to time moving through the forest, warblers and other songbirds. It becomes a little more hit and miss as to whether you get to see birds or not. When you're heading out, they're not as evenly distributed as they are during the nesting season, but it is a good time of year to get out and see what might be moving through. And those numbers of migrants will probably increase in the coming weeks here before, you know, dropping off as we get later into fall. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded and originally aired in May of 2024. I spoke with Greg Jensen, a marine biologist and author or co-author of several field guides. He's based in the Puget Sound region, but was visiting Sitka as part of the Scientist in the Schools program through the Sitka Sound Science Center. You can learn more about his field guides at mullamarine.com. We'll go ahead and join the conversation talking about getting out to the beach as children and with children and go on from there. You're here for the Scientists in the Schools program with the Sitka Sound Science Center, and yep. It is, as we're sitting here, it is the week of the new moon low tides. So we have some -2 tides here predicted this week in the morning, and you get to go out. It's funny, they've been doing Sea Week for at least 40 years, because I was doing it when I was a kid in elementary school. Okay. And so I'm guessing that's kind of what they're doing these days as well. They get field trips to the beach.
Yeah, we have 2 days where we're going out with first graders, and so this last 2 days, we've been kind of doing dry runs in the lab, you know, of how they're going to sample a rock when they get out there on the beach. And then I guess on Friday morning, we go out with kindergartners. And I think that's more just not as structured, but yeah. I'm not quite sure
how it goes. See what's out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when they're sampling, what are they like sampling for something or?
No, they select a rock and put a rope around it kind of to delineate the area that they're going to sample, and then they do counts and tallies of what's on the top of the rock, and then once they've done that, then they carefully flip the rock over, catch whatever's underneath and count those and also the stuff that's attached to the underside of the rock. So
definitely more structured than when I was in first grade. I remember first grade in particular, we got to go over to the causeway, which is on the other side of the airport. Uh-huh. At the time, they let us drive across there in the school bus. We drove across the runway. I don't think they let them do that anymore. But it was always fun. There's not that many specific species that I remember from being a kid. Bullheads, we just called all the little sculpins, you know. Most of them probably the tide pool sculpin. Yeah, and probably others, but we wouldn't have distinguished them, you know, when I was a kid. So, yeah, it was kind of a magical place. There's so much diversity there in such small areas, and it can be a little overwhelming. But you've been at this for, I think you told me yesterday when we were talking, you've been diving for 50 years in Puget Sound, and I imagine you, did you grow up in Puget Sound area?
Yeah. Well, when I was really little, I was into insects and all that kind of thing, and then by the time I got to be about 11 years old, that's when I started getting into marine stuff. So it was like tide book was my Bible.
Right, yeah.
It's like never without that. And every time the new one for the next year would come out, you know, I'd be leafing through it trying to find what the lowest tides of the year were and stuff and make marking those on my calendar. And then I was, you know, trying to find some beach to go to, you know, whether it was getting my parents to drive me somewhere or you know, getting on my bike and riding somewhere. Yeah, just kind of continuously since then been doing stuff. And then I started snorkeling. And then as soon as I was old enough to take scuba without having a parent take it with me, because my parents absolutely were not going to do it.
Yeah.
The moment I turned old enough, I took it and have been doing it ever since.
Yeah. And I suppose for a school age kid in the time that I think that probably the same there as it is here, that the lowest tides are generally in the summer. So you don't
summer
have
summer, and then, you know, like midnight in the
right
winter.
In the wintertime, you have the late ones.
Which I went to those too.
Oh, okay. Well, up late, but so I mean, I guess that made it a little easier. You didn't have to try and get out of school to get down for the low tides, but
right.
So you're just in the beginning, just kind of exploring and seeing what's there, or were you trying to identify things? Or,
well, you know, when I first started out, I was my insect collecting thing sort of carried over to marine stuff, so I was putting together collections of crabs and collections of starfish and all these sorts of things. And after a little while, there was one day I was out collecting. I got home and I, you know, had taken the stuff out of my buckets and preserved it. And I, here at the bottom of the bucket was this little hermit crab, a tiny little thing. I had no interest in having it in my collection. And previously, I'd been doing a lot of aquarium stuff with freshwater things like crayfish and freshwater insects, diving beetles and stuff. And so I had a few kind of all glass containers around. And so I thought, well, you know, what would happen if I just put the salt water in one of those and put him in there and gave him an airstone? And because I couldn't really con my parents into driving me all the way back to the beach to release one little hermit crab. And so I set it up, and he did fine, you know. And then I suddenly realized, you know, hey, I can actually keep these things in my basement, and they were far more interesting alive than dried up. So after that, I quit preserving things and started setting up tanks. And right around that time, they invented the all-glass aquarium. So I got like the first one off the assembly line almost, probably.
Oh, wow.
They invented the clear silicone sealant to make the, that you could make tanks out of. And I actually still have that tank now, some 50 years later, and it's still perfect. I'm more than 50 years, and it's still watertight, believe it or not.
So, yeah, I mean, it seems like basically from the beginning you were interested in natural history of critters, insects in particular, starting out, and then pretty quickly into the beach stuff. And yeah, I mean, hermit crabs, I remember I was reading a weblog. There's a lady that I don't know how old she is, but she grew up on Vancouver Island. She's probably in her 70s or 80s at this point, but she would keep a small aquarium of stuff, and she talked about just watching the hermit crabs and would watch their interactions as they would like negotiate about shells,
right,
for example, and like there was some sort of a knocking thing, and she'd observe this, and then there was a hermit crab in there that needed a new shell or something, and so she actually was trying to mimic that behavior and got this hermit crab to switch shells based on what she'd observed between the hermit crabs doing among themselves, which, you know, I don't know, it was pretty interesting and clearly meaningful for her, and just interesting for me to read about, you know, the it's easy to just, well, they're just animals, you know, I don't know what they're doing down there. And, right. And we're so, have so little opportunity to observe them in the wild because of where they live. And the fact that if they're not underwater, then they're hunkered down waiting for the water to come back.
Right.
And so for many of us, that's the only time we see them.
Right.
Of course, when you're diving, you get a chance to spend a little more time, but in aquariums, even more.
Yeah. Well, if you have a nice tide pool, you know, and a lot of times you can, you know, if it's a nice rocky tide pool, you can sit there and watch, and especially hermit crabs, you'll see them running around doing things. And, you know, it's sometimes you'll see a larger one dragging a smaller one around. And sometimes people think that, you know, the big one is picking on the smaller one, or is trying to get its shell or something. And actually what it is the larger one's a male and the smaller one's a female, and it's dragging it around in preparation for mating. But I heard one story about, you know, somebody that saw this and was so upset by seeing these bigger ones picking on smaller ones, they were sitting there picking all these pairs up and pulling them apart. But there, the thing you mentioned about the knocking on shells, there was a really kind of clever study that was done. So that's part of the sort of language that they use to, tell another crab that they want its shell and they want it to get out. And what it is that the strength with which they smack their shell against this other one's shell, the animal in the shell that's getting hit can sense how hard those hits are and tell from that how, oh geez, that guy's stronger than I am, so I better just let him have my shell.
Yeah.
So it's not a battle where they're grabbing and clawing and pinching and pulling each other out of the shells or something. There's a kind of a language there, and the language actually crosses species barriers because there's different species of hermit crabs, and yet, one species will know that it's a, even though it's a different species, maybe trying to take its shell, they'll know the language. But there was this kind of, I think, kind of clever experiment that showed how they do that, or that's what they were sensing. So he took some crabs that, were definitely the ones that would win if they were banging on another one's shell. Well, the ones that were going to get banged on, he put little rubber pads on their shells. So when this other one would bang on it, the hits would be much quieter, right? And the other ones wouldn't come out of the shell because it's like, oh, there's a wimp that's banging on my shell. I don't care.
And did that escalate from there, or did that because they didn't respond?
I don't recall what followed, but it was just, I just thought that was kind of a very simple yet elegant kind of way of showing that this was the cue,
Yeah, the force. It makes sense that fighting is dangerous, even for the winner, the injury and the cost of the energy and and the risk of injury is pretty high. So figuring out ways that are less dangerous to compare sort of relative likelihood of victory and then and just let it. I mean, I guess humans have done that in some way through sports, I guess, and ways that we have moved away from like pure violence to sort of staged violence, sorts of activities. But it's happening in the animals as well. Hermit crab, that's basically what they're doing.
Or look at things like spider crabs, kelp crabs, there's a really what we call strong sexual dimorphism in that the males have much, much larger claws than the females. And that's because those claws are used in these contests between the males. But, they're not... The battles are quite ritualized in a sense that, nobody actually gets... suffers serious damage. And the analogy I always use is, think about elk. Right, the males have these great big racks of horns that are really could potentially deadly weapons, but elk doesn't wait till the other guy has his back turned and then ream him from behind or something. They square off and they lock and they wrestle and who's stronger, they figure that out. Sometimes things happen and somebody gets hurt, but for the most part, given their weaponry, it's a very civilized sort of way of working out their differences, because they, there's rules basically, and like you say, you could win and still be, have an injury that's just going to get infected and kill you or something. And so, these crabs, you'll see scarring on their claws and stuff, but for the most part, they're not trying to actually damage the opponent. They're just trying to intimidate them, make them realize that the other one's bigger than they are, that they're bigger than the other one. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, so I suppose crabs are not, or at least the crabs we're talking about here, aren't like broadcast spawning. Then they're mating together in a way.
Right. So well, there's all there aren't any crabs. Okay, that actually are broadcast spawners.
So they're all doing that, and so that would I mean, I guess I'm just kind of curious about the nature of competition such as it is. And are all the crustaceans or crabs at least going to have these male on male aggressions to in competition for females, or are there different kind of
there's different mating systems. Yeah. And, you know, we have one kind of crab here that's called a thick clawed porcelain crab. And in those, both the males and the females have these just immense claws. The weight of the claws is more than the rest of the body. You know, it's just kind of crazy large claws. And they're not used for feeding because these crabs are actually filter feeders. So they eat like a barnacle. So they have these mouth parts that they sweep through the water to get plankton and things like that. But they're monogamous. They pair up when they're very small and kind of just grow at the same rate and just stay together, living in, you know, a little small rock cavity or a empty barnacle shell or something like that. You know, so we have, again, that's sort of analogous to what we see on land when you see monogamous birds. You know, you can't tell the male from the female usually because there's none of this fancy plumage, you know, that the males of some species have because they're trying to impress the females or something, because if they're monogamous, there's no need to impress. So, you know, they basically all look the same, and that's the same thing with these crabs. And then you have what we call enforced monogamy. If you've ever dug horse clams, oftentimes find these little crabs living inside.
The pea crabs?
Pea crabs, yeah. Yep. And, you know, that's a case of where you're in there and you're kind of stuck in there. You know, they're very ill-equipped to live outside of a clam. So a male and a female end up inside the clam, and, you know, there's no real need for big claws to fight other males or anything like that because you're in this protected environment. You don't even need a hard shell to defend yourself from predators because you're inside this clam. So a lot of these pea crabs are, you feel them and they're very soft and uncalcified kind of exoskeleton.
Saving the effort of building a stronger house, I guess, if you don't need to.
Yeah. If you don't need it, why have it? Yeah, so we see a lot of different sort of mating systems, and a lot of them, like I say, are, you know, have analogies that are more familiar on land, like the monogamous swans or the battling elk, things like that.
Well, and so I imagine even with scuba gear, you know, there's only so long that you can... I mean, I guess if an animal tends to have a tight fidelity to a particular patch, you can observe it over time. If you have especially if you have some way of marking it and indicating that. But I imagine a lot of this work is done via aquarium studies, or is that?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
You know, there's crabs that, you know, do the something equivalent to a lek.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
So like, you know, with a prairie chickens that form, the males have the
everybody
little area.
Kinda.
And, you know, we have a little crab called the pygmy cancer crab. It's a small relative of Dungeness. It only gets to be about the size of a silver dollar. And, you know, a male will kind of own a little apartment complex with, you know, all these other barnacle shells that are, you know, where the females are inhabiting, and he'll sort of mate with, you know, a number of different females in that little area. It's just a fascinating, to me, a really fascinating area of crustacean biology, just looking at all the different strategies that are being used, both in crabs and shrimps and these other things too.
So it sounds like there's a pretty wide diversity of mating systems and strategies across crustaceans, of crabs and shrimps. In hindsight, you know, with birds, for example, we did some banding here and found out, you know, in hindsight, it wasn't surprising, but I didn't really think about it before, but birds that would leave a song sparrow, for example, that was in my yard. We banded it in my yard. I observed it there throughout the winter. It left in April. We didn't see it anymore. And then around August, it was back again. Hmm. And then it was there throughout that winter. I think we had it two full winters. And then it left in the summer again, came back. And then after a month, it was gone. So at that point, probably something had got it, you know, yeah. One way or the other. But it was like, oh, wow, this bird is coming back to the same place.
Real good sight for the
right.
fidelity there.
Yeah. Which, you know, makes some sense because you already know what's there, right? And yeah. You know what where the food tends to be, you know where the danger tends to be. And so why would you want to learn a completely new area when
right.
you already have a familiarity with that? And so I don't, like underwater, it's I imagine there are some animals that move around pretty broadly, but I imagine there's others that are because I don't differentiate them very well. I mean, obviously some are stuck in place, barnacles, but right. like limpets, for example, like, do they come back to the same place again, or are they just like wandering around, or like, and maybe it depends on the species, but like that's something I've been kind of curious about. How does
it does depend on the species. I think it's, there's a tendency for the ones that are higher up in the intertidal mm-hmm. to have a specific spot that they return to. So when the tide's in, they'll move out and graze. But then as the tide recedes, they'll come back and they've got their little home scar. And it, like I say, literally a scar. It'll be a mark, a little indentation around in the rock where they've kind of been there, keep going to that same spot. And that allows them to seal more tightly, retain moisture. During the time when the tide's out and the sun's shining on them and that sort of thing. I suspect that, you know, most of the very low and the intertidal and subtidal ones probably don't have as much fidelity. They don't have quite the reason for it. But, that's just my guess.
Yeah.
I haven't actually studied that.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it would become challenging for the ones that are subtitle, especially to just have enough. I guess you could mark them a little easier than some other things.
Mollusks are one of the easier ones to put some sort of tag on or something because they've got, you know, a shell.
Yeah.
You can, you know, whereas tagging a crab, you know, you can put something on it, but then when it molts, you lose that tag.
Yeah.
That's one of the difficulties with crabs is that, you know, there's no easy way to age them. It's not like you can, it's not like a fish where you can take out an otolith, ear bone, and count the rings on it or something like that. Because every time the crab molts, it's basically losing all of its hard parts. So most of the age estimations that you see on crustaceans are based on size. And that's not very reliable because just depending on their conditions, some of them grow a lot faster than others. So they, a larger crab might not be as old as a smaller crab that's from a different location, not far away.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess the curiosity I have around the, you know, we talked a little bit about the mating systems, but is there social structure, like hierarchical structure of these animals, or is it just simply, I could imagine, for example, like there's preferred locations that whatever the species happens to like and is ideal, like there's the best location.
Right.
And some crab or shrimp has got that. And then like there's this cascade of like less good.
Right.
And sort of a hierarchy is maintained in that respect.
So I had, you know, I did a lot of work with porcelain crabs. They're ones that they're in the same general group as the monogamous crabs I was talking about, but these are not monogamous, these other ones. And so they live in large numbers underneath rocks, and they're filter feeders. And there's certainly, you know, some places under the rock that are going to be much better for water circulation, for filtering while still being sheltered by the rock. And these animals have these, again, very large claws, and they fight like crazy. If you take a bunch of strange ones and put them under a rock and observe, when I was doing the work, you know, I had an aquarium set up that you know, had a glass bottom, and then I'd lay on the floor underneath it. And, cold lab floor, and watch what was all these little battles that were going on underneath this rock. But they establish a hierarchy. I mean, they just, you know, figure out who's stronger, and they, you know, after that, once they've got it worked out, you know, all they have to do is, if a crab approaches them, they've got these long antenna, and they just, you know, take an antenna and touch the back of the other crab, and immediately they know whether it's somebody that can displace them or it isn't. And so the battles pretty much go away, because everybody sort of knows where they are.
Did you
where they stand in the hole.
Yeah. Did you have a sense of how long it took for them to sort out? I mean, I imagine there's a lot of factors that could influence that. But
not very long. You know, I'd say 3 or 4 days, maybe.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it, and, you know, the crabs, I could identify the crabs by scars and by their coloration. And, you know, the ones that had the older exoskeletons, the ones that had been a longer time since they last molted, they tended to dominate over the nice, clean, newly, more recently molted ones. And again, it's probably because they had more time to build up a thicker exoskeleton and more muscle.
So it wasn't necessarily strictly about size.
No,
then.
No. Yeah. So
So when molting happened, that would there be a sorting, a resorting, or I mean, I guess I don't know if they all molt at the same time, or how that exactly that works. And
that's a really good question, and I didn't hold them for a long enough time to I mean, that wasn't specifically what I was studying. This is just kind of a byproduct of some other stuff that I was studying. But you know, that's a really good question. At least in a few other crustaceans that have been studied, there's kind of the indication that, you know, once you're sort of the boss, you stay the boss even once you've...
You might have a vulnerable
stage.
Even
though you have a vulnerable stage.
But they aren't testing you.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, in many cases... So crustaceans release urine basically through their faces. And so, you know, when a couple of crabs square off, you know, it looks like it's mostly visual cues, you know, because that's what we see. So we see them doing these displays with their claws and things like that. But at the same time, there's this whole invisible world going on of them basically spraying urine in each other's faces that can inform them as to where they stand relative to that other one. So, and you know, if a crab is a kind of a consistent loser, you know, it doesn't even have to fight the other one. It just knows that it's kind of going to be the loser and backs down, even though it might, if they actually fought, it might actually win. There's a crab that's very common down in Washington called a sharp-nosed crab, and the males have these tremendously long claws, and they do this display where they get just nose to nose to each other, and they spread their claws out, and it looks like they're like measuring each other up, right? And they'll stay in this position. I saw a pair of them stay in this position in an aquarium at the Seattle Aquarium. I was volunteering there and working in the area where they had the crabs. And so these two stayed in that position for 45 minutes. Just neither one would back down. And if neither of them back down, then it does escalate to where they start fighting. But another occasion in the field, I saw a pair of them squared off, and one of them was missing a claw entirely. And yet the other one didn't seem to even know that. So they were in that position. But I mean, these crabs have horrible, horrible vision. And, you know, so what appears to us to be this measuring contest, there was probably just, you know, the real information exchange was going on in this urine that they're spraying in each other's face.
So, like, yeah, chemo hormonal kind of stuff happening.
Yep.
That's that's kind of funny. I suppose, you know, it just, yeah, makes me wonder about like the porcelain crabs, and if you have an established hierarchy and one goes in, like, does it have to fight all of them, or is it only like one new one, or is
does it
pretty quickly find its place in
where it is in the pecking order?
Yeah. And, you know, so just lots of little, like, I wonder how that works. I mean, it's not so often in the wild that they would have random, other than people, like, oh, I found this crab and I'm just going to drop it off over under this rock, you know?
Yeah.
Other than that, I would imagine that that doesn't happen so often unless you have crabs that are prone to going on walkabout for whatever reason. And
yeah, well, I mean, you know, these crabs, actually, one of the things I was studying was there were so crabs undergo a period in the plankton of where they're developing, and they don't look like crabs at all, and then they molt to a stage that's called a megalop stage, and it looks like a cross between a crab and a shrimp, and it's a very good stage. It's very good at swimming, and that the function of that stage is to make that transition from being a planktonic larva to being a benthic juvenile. And it turns out, what I figured out in my studies was that in these two species of porcelain crabs I was studying, these megalopi selectively settle with adults of their own species. And these two species live at different levels on the beach. So, you know, if you took the species that lives lower on the beach and transplanted some adults into a cage higher on the beach, you could make the babies settle at the wrong level on the beach.
Hmm.
And vice versa. Well, when they first settled, then they actually use the adults for protection. So, you know, they're not, you know, these are larvae that have been out in the plankton for a couple months. So they're not the actual progeny of the ones that are under that particular rock, but they're, since the adults are not predatory, since they're just filter feeders, they have this great little refuge underneath the adults. Protection from things like those tide pool sculpins and clingfish and stuff like that. So they settle underneath there and are there for several molts. And it's once they start to reach sexual maturity, then they're no longer tolerated by the adults. And I think the ones at that point, you know, if it's too crowded under the rock, then those are the ones that kind of maybe have to move somewhere else. And then figure out where they fit in the hierarchy and in the new spot. But you know, once you're an adult porcelain crab, I don't think you really move around at
pretty
all.
Sedentary it's, at that point.
You got your rock and you're set.
And how do you know how long these are living?
At least 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're fairly long-lived.
I mean, the flat-top porcelain crab here is pretty common at some of the beaches anyway.
That's one of the ones I was studying.
Okay,
That's the one that was lower on the beach.
All right. Yeah, and it's fascinating to think they're not that big, but 10 years, that's
right.
Some of them are.
I mean, it's longer than a Dungeness crab lives.
Yeah,
you know? But, you know, they're putting out a lot fewer eggs.
Oh, okay.
Per year, so they kind of have to make up for it with a little longer lifespan.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the other thing that is, you know, you mentioned that just like touching the antenna on the back of the crab, they could tell if that was, you know, how they would fare in, you know, where they were in the hierarchy, I guess, at that point. And that makes me suspect that, I mean, it makes it sound like to me, and I don't know if there's any way to know, but that they're identifying in each other as individuals. Like they recognize from that, you know, we see, you know, we're very visual, but we also recognize voices and other aspects of people that we can identify individuals as, especially people we're familiar with. So I guess it's not surprising if you're going to live in that kind of tight environment where there's that sort of a hierarchy that you definitely...
You know, you're under a rock, right? How much light is there?
right. So it's different factors than, you know, visual. Yeah. We're just so visually dominant that it's easy to think in those terms. But
exactly.
But they're basically, they know everybody. They know all the neighbors and how they, you know, whatever feelings that they might have about the neighbors, they keep to themselves, I guess. I don't know how to interpret those, but who knows? They could have a rich inner life. Yeah, it's funny to think of porcelain crab soap operas, I suppose, that
well, you know, speaking of porcelain crab soap operas, I mean, this sounds a little mean, but I guess I could say I discovered the fact that these thick-clawed porcelain crabs are monogamous. And so I was curious as to, you know, I mean, so if you have this male and female living together, if you take the male or the female away and you put in one of the opposite sex, a strange one, they won't accept it. Mm. I mean, you know, even though they're the female's mate is gone, a new male, you know, you put him in there and she attacks him, like, you know, very violently and drives him out, won't let him come in. So I was curious, you know, how long before they start accepting another crab? What's their memory for their particular mate? Or how long after you've taken a crab away can you reintroduce it and have it accepted right back? Or will it treat it like it's a stranger? And so I obviously, you know, had to use quite a few different pairs of crabs to do these separations for different times and stuff. But it turned out to be their memory for their mate was, you know, like 2.5-3 days.
Okay.
Which is, you know, probably better than, like, these celebrities.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was, and the system is very much kind of female dominated, in the sense that the female's the one that really sort of decides as to who the male is going to be that's in this relationship. If it's a small male and you put it in, you know, if a female's been separated for a long time, and it, regardless of how long she's been separated, a new crab coming in, new male crab, she's going to attack it. And if it's a small male, he can't take it and he ends up leaving. If it's a much larger male, he can withstand the attack, but after a while he kind of seems to end up pushing her out because, well, I don't know. But if the male is equal in size, she'll kind of beat up on him for a day or so and then finally accept him as a new partner. So it's, I don't know, it soap opera is the right term.
It sounds like it. Yeah, this kind of 2 or 3 day window of memory where presumably at that point she'll just accept straight away her prior mate. And so if you move a female, is it the same sort of dynamic where she's the one that's going to be aggressive in a new place towards the male that's already there?
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, the males don't seem to be quite as defensive as the females when you add a new one. It definitely, you know, it seems to be more of a female choice kind of thing.
I guess I was just wondering how...
Really, it's really violent.
Yeah,
They don't actually do any damage, but, you know, these crabs have, like I say, enormous claws, and you can hear these loud crunching sounds and everything as she's, you know, pinching these guys' claws, you know, and pushing them out. And you kind of expect to see damage. I haven't seen them actually break anything. But
Yeah, so it sounds like it's less about, you know, this is my home and I'm defending it, and more about we're here together and you need to be acceptable to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the cool things about it, too, is that, you know, with a lot of crabs, they can only mate when the female is newly molted and soft, right? So like a Dungeness crab or a Red Rock crab, you know, when the female's getting close to molting, she's releasing a pheromone that causes the males to grasp onto her, and he'll carry her around for 1 or 2 weeks until, you know, she finally molts and he can mate with her. And you'll continue to guard her for a while afterwards while she's still soft, because when she's newly molted, you know, just about anything can come along and eat her. I mean, even a sculpin that's much smaller can come along and start pulling legs off. I mean, because I don't know if you ever felt a soft crab, but I mean, it's soft.
Yeah.
You know, it's very vulnerable. So, you know, in a sense, he's sort of guarding his investment because he's mated with her, and, you know, if she immediately gets eaten, it's kind of a wasted mating. In the case of these porcelain crabs, they're paired up, male and female together. When the male molts, he's got this female there who defends him.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes both ways. It's this kind of neat equal partnership in that regard.
Yeah.
Whereas in a Dungeness crab, when the males molt, they're kind of on their own.
They have to just try and hide, basically, until...
Yeah. Well, it's also, you know, I've been seeing more and more evidence that... they tend to do this kind of mass molting where all the males in an area kind of get in one spot and all molt kind of at about the same time. And that's probably a way of, you know, basically overwhelming. I mean, you know, predators can only eat so many.
Right.
Right. So
it's kind of a schooling behavior almost.
Yeah. Yeah. So in these places where this happens, you know, there'll be, you know, crab molts, you know, 4 or 5 bodies thick on the bottom. Just, you know, the bottom will just be completely covered with these molts from that.
And so that's what's going on. Yeah. I might have seen that a couple of times. It was just like, it seemed like there was an awful lot of crab shells.
Yeah. Well, usually the females tend to molt, you know, a lot of pretty much around the same time as well, not the same time as the males, obviously, but I mean for the mating purposes. And that's where we, you know, almost every year we get phone calls, you know, saying, oh, there's a mass mortality of crabs out on the coast, you know, I was out there and there was dead crabs just covering the beach and stuff. And every time anybody checks it out, it's just crab molts.
I've noticed that with shore crabs, you know, the small ones, just mm-hmm. like, and I don't remember what time of year exactly, but
yeah, there are
just times
when
that it would just be like
to
tons
be
of them.
A lot of them. Yeah,
yeah. And you know, if you pick one up, you can kind of the back of it lifts up a little bit, and,
right?
But otherwise, it looks like a whole crab, and I'm like, oh,
yeah,
it must be a molt.
Yeah, if you look at the eyes,
okay,
yeah, you know, dead crab, the eyes will still be dark, you know, and molt, they'll just be clear.
Okay. Yeah.
There's that, and then there's what I call a sniff test.
Oh.
And in that case, you know, once you've picked it up, you can pretty much smell your fingers and tell whether it was a dead crab
dead
or not.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense.
And you'll smell it on your fingers for the next few days.
Yeah, not a pleasant smell for most of us. I've been noticing on iNaturalist, people not around Sitka specifically, but elsewhere in Southeast Alaska, posting pictures of these like agglomerations of, they look like they're pretty small king crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a similar sort of behavior where they're coming together to molt, perhaps?
No, that's actually, so red king crabs specifically do that. And so the juveniles, it's thought to be a predator deterrent kind of thing. So they form what are called pods. And that's, you know, typically in the daytime, they form these big pods, and then at night they'll sort of disperse to feed on things and then reassemble it.
Oh.
When they feel the daytime coming back.
Yeah.
In. Yeah.
That's it. So they're going out and foraging basically at night, and then and then kind of having the big get together for protection during the day when they, I guess, would have more threats, presumably.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, when there's much smaller than they're living individually, because they're able to kind of hide, you know, smaller, you know,
so it's
under
just the
shells
intermediate
and stuff
size
like that.
Ones.
But once they get to a certain kind of intermediate size, they do that, which is, you know, very different from like blue king crab that don't do that potting.
Oh, okay. So that's and I think, that's what they were being identified as, is red king crab. I don't have a lot of experience with king crab directly. I don't know that I've ever even seen one in the wild. They don't seem to be so prevalent here in Sitka Sound area, more inside, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you're sort of getting towards the southern end of the range. The furthest south I think any of them have ever been found is like the north end of Vancouver Island.
Oh, okay.
So, you know.
Yeah.
You're not. But, yeah, there's Should be somewhere around here.
Yeah. Well, I imagine there are, and I imagine, you know, it's not so far away, some of these pictures, and I know people have caught them. It's just, they're finding them. The people that were posting pictures, I don't think were diving, so they were, like,
I saw the naturalist picture, and it looked like it was just a shallow, like a, almost like a tide pool.
Yeah. Thing. But I think some people at Juneau were finding them intertidally during some of the winter low tides and just like small ones. But so I've never seen those here, but it's colder in Juneau. So like if that's, and that might make some sense, but yeah, it is interesting, you know, just thinking about the ranges of things and, you know, where as things shift over time, ranges shift, or also just not knowing what ranges are, because there's not really that many. I mean, Sitka's on the outer coast, but there's really nothing on the outer coast of significant population between Sitka and what, Vancouver Island, maybe? I guess Haida Gwaii, I don't know if they have anything on the outer coast of Haida Gwaii population wise. So this not is much. Like a lot of country that doesn't have a lot of people.
Right.
And so coverage of observing, especially if you're talking about things that aren't necessarily easily observed by regular fisher people or, you know, beachcombers kind of thing, just like it's hard to know. But I imagine, you know, spending 50 years diving in one kind of area, have you seen a lot of shifts in or many shifts in kind of abundance and how things are occurring or whether they're occurring or not?
I mean, certainly, you know, there's been more California things showing up in Washington. You know, things that either when I was a kid, you know, only showed up in an El Nino year, and, you know, now they're kind of almost established. You know, there's just large changes in areas, mostly, you know, like some of the areas that have been made into preserves, marine reserves, no fishing areas, you know, that had nothing in them years ago. And then, you know, after 10 years or so of being a reserve, they're just, you know, flush with rockfish and lingcod and all sorts of things. We really do need more of that sort of kind of areas, because, you know, there are a number of studies done in other parts of the world have found it, you know, if you have these areas, then the overflow from them go into the places where people can fish. And so you basically increase populations for across the board, because these areas can only sustain so many fish. So you start getting a bleed over.
So it's kind of a source population for that ultimately allows a replenishment of the fish that are being caught elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, it sounds like there might be more than one marine reserve that was set up in that area. And you mentioned like over a few years, the abundance just like was dramatic, the shift in abundance and species that were even present from the sounds of it. Do you have a sense, I guess I don't know if anybody did a systematic study of it or whether you were going there frequently enough to get a sense of how that came back, you know, like was there a regular process that sort of like of succession, essentially underwater succession sort of thing that was going on, like some species were pioneers and then it kind of gradually developed into this sort of longer term stability?
Well, can't really speak to that. Because I didn't, you know, consistently observe the area over the years, but there are places where they've put in reefs that have been kind of monitored, sort of right from the start. So there's a area called Saltwater State Park that, you know, the existing bottom there was just a basically sand mud sort of bottom, and mostly sand, and you know, they put in three very large reefs made out of concrete columns and things that were left over from freeway construction or something like that, and big rocks, and So we do have, we continue to monitor that. And it's, you know, it's pretty dramatic. You put something like that in, you immediately start getting rockfish, things like that. They're just attracted to having that extra shelter. So even before you're getting a population of invertebrates on the rocks or stuff, you know, even when it's still just bare rock, you get these things moving in. It's pretty dramatic. And you know, 15 years later, it's still the same species of rockfish that are there. You know?
Yeah. Maybe the same rockfish, I suppose.
Yeah, could be. But one of the dangers of putting in, you know, just randomly putting in reefs like that is that they found that it doesn't just attract the big rockfish, it attracts the smaller rockfish as well. And the smaller rockfish can get eaten by the bigger rockfish. So what they found is that if they create adjacent areas with much smaller, much lower relief kind of rock rubble, that can serve as a nursery basically for these smaller rockfish to settle in, where they're well protected down in these smaller crevices and things out of reach of the lingcod and the larger rockfish. And then once they get bigger, they kind of graduate and can move on to the larger material. So you know, the whole artificial reef thing, you know, is kind of an ongoing learning process. You know, there's oftentimes people that, you know, sort of push, or divers in particular, that push for this, you know, oh, sink all the extra boats and do all this, you know, kind of thing to create, because they've seen how quickly these things become established. But, you know, those fish that moved in, you know, they didn't grow up overnight. They just moved from some other place to that spot. So, you know, it's not that initial pulse of fish that you're getting in there is not a product of that structure. It's a, you know, it's stealing from somewhere.
Yeah.
In a sense. But without having, you know, the proper other structure in there to support the smaller fish, it's not a long-term sustainable sort of thing.
It's interesting to think about. I mean, there are, I suppose, flatfish and so forth that like the sandy bottoms, and
right.
And so there are species that like those. And then, but for other species, that's essentially a desert for them, I guess. It's like there's nothing there for them, and like no home for
right.
them there. So you add in this structure, and I guess it makes sense, as you're saying it, like the relative size of the structure is appealing. The fact that their structure is appealing to lots of fish, but it's much better suited for some fish than others.
Right.
And so having just this large structure in the middle of this otherwise barren area, it's like, well, any port in a storm, so to speak, for these small fish, but ultimately that's not great for them. So having a more varied kind of thinking about it a little more holistically, I guess, I know we're going to put this one reef in and it's going to make things better, or at least make things more of a certain kind of fishy here.
Yeah. Yeah. So the one at the Saltwater State Park, the one I mentioned where they put in the three huge structures with the pillars and stuff, you know, just to the shoreward side of that, they put in kind of fields of broken rubble rock, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, they did it right.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to get them to do now is to take out the 3,000 tires or whatever it is.
It's
to the north of the big reefs, and replace them with kind of patch reefs of rock to provide some more kind of smaller habitat for things.
Yeah.
And you know, being little patch reefs, you know, there's still plenty of open ground between for flatfish and gooey ducks and things like that. So we're kind of still hoping that we can get that done.
Is there a pretty big diving community in Puget Sound? That's like, I mean, it's interesting. That's like, it sounds like this is an underwater state park. Or does it also have an on-land component to it?
Yeah, it's a land state park, but the area out in front is a marine preserve.
I see.
Part of the park.
I see. And is there a significant community of divers and so forth in Puget Sound that are, you know, regularly diving on these reefs?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's a lot of people in Puget Sound area, so yep. Only takes a tiny fraction of them to make quite a few divers out there.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great to chat. And anything else that you'd like to mention here before we wrap up?
No. Just been here a few days, but I've really enjoyed my time here in Sitka. I wish the weather was better.
We were a week late for that, I guess. Last week was the sunny weather. And so if folks want to see the guides that you have put together, molamarine.com is the place to go for that.
Yeah.
All right, great. And, you know, having looked at them myself, it's such a different world. You know, I have some copies of the older sorts of things where, like, there's line drawings in a few places and lots of technical terminology. And I'm just like, okay, I don't know if I'm ready to wade into all of that. So having these full color things with, you know, species in their habitat sort of things and pointers to, like, this is the things to look for this one versus this other similar one. It's such a shortcut to learning what we have around us. So,
yeah, having color photographs. When I started out, you know, all it was available was keys.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If not this, then this kind of thing. And, you know, you're working your way through a key and then you come up with a name and there was nothing to check the name against. You couldn't go, okay, let me look that up. You know, there was no Googling and seeing what image search or anything like that, you know. So, in putting the books together, I kind of, you know, put myself in the place of somebody who's just trying to learn what these things are what sort of language would be understandable to them, you know, avoiding the technical terms and giving them good pictures. And hopefully I think I've achieved that pretty well with those books. And you know, there's always going to be things that are sticky, that are hard to things that are so similar to each other that, you know, you almost have to get them under a scope or something to tell them apart. But it's certainly a lot easier now for a lot of these things than it was when I started.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate the you know, the description of, okay, this is habitat and where you can expect them, range, you know, like if I'm seeing something, if I'm looking in Sitka and its range, northern extent of its range is Washington, it doesn't mean that it didn't show up here, but that shouldn't be the first place I'm looking, right?
Right.
Excluding things that way. And then, like, I always love when there's a similar species note.
Right.
And granted, in my experience, sometimes the folks that are writing the books have a much more refined sense of what similar is than I do, but at least it's given me some pointers of, okay, let's compare these two and see and start to notice those differences and really cue in on those. Cause it's at the beginning, it's just overwhelming. There's just like, you don't even know what you're looking at kind of thing. It's just all too much. And so being able to focus attention to these things that matter for these cases is that I find really helpful. So yeah, I certainly recommend the books myself, and those and many others are available for like all the things in the world. Well, not all the things. There are definitely some things that are a little short on the field guides side of things, but we keep hoping and they keep coming out more of them. So, well, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded and originally aired back in the spring of 2024. I was speaking with Greg Jensen, a marine biologist based in the Puget Sound region. He was in Sitka as part of the Scientists in Schools program through the Sitka Sound Science Center. I want to thank him for taking some time to visit with me during his visit here. And thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. Or you can check out my website, sitkanature.org. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.